Welcome in, and thank you so much for joining us for another deep dive.
Yeah, it is great to be here.
If you are someone who just loves uncovering the fascinating and sometimes totally chaotic backstories behind the things we think we already know intimately, you are in the exact right place today.
You really are. We have a great one today.
We absolutely do. We are taking a beloved, iconic piece of 90s cinema and looking really closely at its incredibly turbulent journey to the live stage.
Which is quite a journey.
Oh, it's wild. We are talking about the musical adaptation of Mrs. Doubtfire.
A classic.
Right. And to guide us today, we are utilizing an incredibly detailed Wikipedia article that chronicles the production's globe-trotting, highly unpredictable history.
It is a phenomenal source. It really tracks every twist and turn.
It does. And our mission for this deep dive is to map out exactly how a classic film navigates the transition to the stage, survives a literal global pandemic, undergoes a massive creative overhaul, and then translates across international borders. So, just a casual Tuesday.
Just a small undertaking.
Right. Okay, let's unpack this.
Well, it is a remarkable timeline, and it really challenges our basic assumptions about how commercial theater gets made.
How so?
I mean, when we look at theatrical adaptations of massive cultural touchstones like Mrs. Doubtfire, we tend to assume there's this straightforward pipeline, right?
Right, like a producer buys the rights, hires a writer, and boom, suddenly you have an opening night.
Exactly. But the reality is almost never that clean. The story of the Mrs. Doubtfire musical is fundamentally a masterclass in resilience and really the brutal reality of theatrical development.
Yeah.
It demonstrates how a show has to constantly evolve and weather unbelievable friction just to survive in this industry.
And that friction, it actually started a lot earlier than most people realize.
Oh, definitely.
Because the musical running today actually had a completely different inception point back in 2015.
Right, the first attempt.
Yeah, the original developmental team featured legendary composer Alan Menken and lyricist David Zippel.
Which is just wild to consider.
It really is. I mean, Alan Menken, the literal architect of the Disney Renaissance, tackling the score for a frantic, messy divorce comedy.
It's a very different vibe from Beauty and the Beast.
Just a bit. But even more fascinating is the source material's note on who was co-writing the book. It was Harvey Fierstein.
Yes, which is such a brilliant connection.
Right. Now, to be clear, for anyone who isn't a massive theater regular, when we say he was writing the book, we mean he was writing the actual spoken dialogue and the narrative structure between the musical
Right,
numbers.
the skeleton of the show.
Exactly. And having Fierstein do that is incredible because, well, he actually played Frank in the 1993 movie.
The brother who physically builds the Mrs. Doubtfire disguise,
Yes, Uncle Frank.
which injects an incredible amount of insider DNA directly into the script. Fierstein understands the specific comedic rhythm of that story from the inside out.
Oh, absolutely.
The producer, Kevin McCollum, even stated back in 2013 that the plot was perfectly tailored for Broadway. And, you know, it seemed like an absolute dream team on paper.
It really did.
But theatrical alchemy is incredibly delicate. Having brilliant individual talents in the room does not guarantee that the collective machine will function.
Right.
By 2016, just a year after that initial buzz, Menken publicly announced that the project had been put on a creative hiatus, specifically citing changes in the creative team.
Which is code for things were not working.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is actually a very common, albeit painful, part of Broadway development.
Yeah, the source material makes it clear it just stalled out.
The tonal gap between Menken's sweeping classical style and a chaotic 90s farce might have just been too wide to bridge. Sometimes adaptations require a completely new vocabulary to finally find their theatrical voice.
And they certainly went searching for a new vocabulary because by 2018, the project was totally rebooted.
A completely fresh start.
Yeah, it is essentially like deciding to tear a house all the way down to the studs because the foundation wasn't sitting right, and then bringing in an entirely new architectural team.
That's a great way to put it.
They brought on Carey and Wayne Kirkpatrick to compose a brand new score, and Carey teamed up with John O'Farrell to write a new book.
Right.
And to steer this entirely new vision, they hired four-time Tony Award-winning director Jerry Zaks.
A total reset.
Yeah.
And that new team had to make some foundational choices about the world these characters were going to inhabit.
Well, they had a lot of source material to draw from,
Oh,
right?
absolutely. The core of the narrative is still heavily based on the 1993 film, which, as a quick historical footnote, was actually based on the 1987 novel Madame Doubtfire by Anne Fine.
I always forget it was a book first.
A lot of people do, but the creative team wisely kept the setting in San Francisco, California.
Well, they had to.
Yeah, the geography of that city with its steep hills and distinct neighborhoods is baked right into the identity of the story.
For sure.
But they made a massive, deliberate pivot regarding the timeline. They refused to treat the material as a 90s period piece. They updated the time frame entirely to the 21st century.
Which is a massive creative risk if you think about it.
It is a huge gamble.
You are taking a story deeply rooted in 90s nostalgia, like a world of analog answering machines and dial-up internet, and forcing it into the era of the iPhone. The stage show is packed with references to modern technology, internet culture, and modern social dynamics that simply did not exist when the movie was made.
What's fascinating here is why this modernization matters so much for the mechanics of a stage comedy.
Okay, break that down for us.
Well, comedy at this scale relies heavily on immediate relatability. For an audience to buy into the absurdity, they need to recognize the rules of the world the characters are living in.
Right.
By updating the technological landscape, the creators fundamentally altered the mechanics of Daniel's elaborate ruse.
Because hiding your identity in 1993 just meant intercepting a landline phone call, altering your voice, and putting on some heavy makeup.
Precisely.
Yeah.
But in the 21st century, pulling off the Mrs. Doubtfire deception means navigating a world where every single person has a high-definition camera in their pocket.
That is so true.
It means dealing with social media tracking, ring cameras on front porches, and digital footprints. It exponentially raises the stakes of his physical disguise.
Oh, totally.
If he slips up for even a second, he isn't just caught by his ex-wife. He could be caught on a smartphone and broadcast to the world?
And the music actually had to evolve to match that new high-anxiety energy. The K Kirkpatrick's completely original score really reflects this modernized, frantic plot.
It definitely moves at a fast clip.
Yeah, looking at the Broadway track list from our source, you have numbers like Make Me a Woman, which covers the frantic creation of the disguise,
Yeah.
and then songs like Easy Peasy and Big Fat Note.
Very energetic.
Very. But digging into the source material reveals something I just love about theater, how fluid it is, even after opening night.
Oh, the constant revisions.
Yes. For example, the opening number for the 2021 Broadway production was a song called What's Wrong with This Picture? But by the time the show launched its 2023 North American tour and opened in London, they had completely scrapped that opening. They replaced it with a brand new song called That's Daniel.
Which fundamentally shifts the psychological entry point for the audience.
How so?
Well, swapping out a song like What's Wrong with This Picture, which sort of implies a broader, more ensemble-focused look at a fractured family dynamic, for a song titled That's Daniel forces the audience to immediately zero in on Daniel's specific manic energy the moment the curtain rises.
Oh, I see.
It tells the audience exactly whose brain we are living inside for the next 2.5 hours.
That makes total sense. And that constant tinkering was necessary because this show was forged in a crucible, unlike anything modern Broadway has ever experienced.
Truly unprecedented.
Because the initial launch was actually incredibly promising. They had their world premiere at the Fifth Avenue Theater in Seattle, Washington, in late 2019.
A great tryout town.
Yeah. Previews started on November 26th. It officially opened on December 13th, and it was originally slated to run just through the end of the year. But the Seattle audiences absolutely ate it up.
They loved it.
They did. It was extended due to popular demand until January 4, 2020. They had a verifiable hit on their hands.
They captured the exact momentum every out-of-town tryout dreams of. You build the hype in a city like Seattle, you refine the jokes, and you ride that wave of positive word of mouth straight into New York.
But riding that wave into New York in early 2020 came with consequences literally no one could have predicted.
No one.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Though honestly, it's a tragically ironic timeline.
It really is heartbreaking.
The production moved to the Stephen Sondheim Theater. Their first Broadway preview took place on March 9th, 2020.
Wow.
Just sit with that date for a second. March 9th. Just 72 hours later, on March 12th, the governor suspended all Broadway productions in response to the coronavirus pandemic.
3 days.
They got 3 days of previews, and then the doors were padlocked.
It is hard to overstate the emotional, financial, and logistical whiplash of that specific moment for a theatrical company.
I can't even imagine.
You spend years in development, you survive out-of-town tryouts, you finally step onto a Broadway stage, and 3 days later, the entire world shuts down indefinitely. Costumes are literally left hanging in dressing rooms for a year and a half.
Just frozen in time.
Exactly. And the reality of their eventual return was a brutal, exhausting stop-and-go marathon.
Right, because they couldn't even resume previews until October 21, 2021. And then they finally officially opened on December 5.
But even then, the industry was incredibly fragile.
Yeah, the winter of 2021 was tough.
The Omicron surge hit New York hard, forcing the production into a grueling 9-week hiatus from January 10th, 2022, all the way through mid-April.
Another shutdown.
Yes. They reopened for about a month, but the momentum was permanently fractured. The producers ultimately announced the show would close on May 29th, 2022. It only managed to log 43 previews and 83 regular performances.
It is a heartbreaking trajectory when you look at the raw data. But the pandemic didn't just decimate the production schedule. It took a profound, deeply personal toll on the company itself.
It did.
The original cast featured an actress named Doreen Montalvo, who played Janet Lundy, the television executive. She was a crucial part of the highly successful Seattle run, and she was there for those three brief pre-COVID previews in March 2020.
Yeah.
Tragically, during the long Broadway shutdown, she passed away suddenly in October 2020.
It is a sobering reminder of the very real human element operating behind the artifice of a comedy.
It really is.
The loss of Doreen Montalvo was a massive blow to the theater community. It makes the fact that this specific company managed to hold together, return to that theater, and finally open the show in late 2021 all the more poignant. They were carrying an immense amount of emotional weight onto that stage every night.
Absolutely. And despite that heavy emotional toll, despite the brutal stop and go of the pandemic, and despite the painfully brief Broadway run, the property itself refused to be boxed in by that New York closure.
It really found a second life.
Fast forward to today, sitting here in March of 2026, and the global footprint of Mrs. Doubtfire is staggering. It completely rose from the ashes of that Broadway disappointment to find massive audiences everywhere else.
The international embrace happened remarkably fast, actually.
It really did. Where did they go first?
Well, by late 2022, the musical made its UK premiere at the Manchester Opera House. Importantly, it received generally favorable reviews there, which served as the crucial launching pad it needed for the West End.
Ah, proving it could work overseas.
Exactly. The production successfully transferred to London's Shaftesbury Theatre in May of 2023. They brought in a British actor, Gabriel Vick, to take on the monumental physical and vocal demands of Daniel Hillard.
And how did it do there?
It found its footing beautifully, secured positive reviews, and enjoyed a very healthy, sustained run, ultimately closing just last year in April 2025.
That's fantastic. And while the UK audiences were packing the Shaftesbury Theatre, the show was simultaneously hitting the road back here in the States.
The touring market is huge.
It is. The first North American national tour launched in Buffalo, New York in the fall of 2023, and it ran all the way through November 2024. And I have to say, my absolute favorite piece of trivia from this tour is the casting.
Oh, it's such a great detail.
Rob McClure, the actor who originated the role on Broadway and really anchored the show through the darkest days of the pandemic, actually returned to play Daniel Hillard on the road.
Which is rare for a leading man of that caliber to do.
Right. But this time, his onstage ex-wife, Miranda Hillard, was played by Maggie Lacus, who happens to be his actual real-life wife.
Which introduces such a fascinating meta-theatrical layer to the performance.
Yeah, it really does.
You have two actors who are happily married in reality, tasked with navigating a highly contentious, messy on-stage divorce 8 times a week.
Talk about bringing your work home with you.
Seriously, it provides a very unique chemistry and subtext that you simply cannot manufacture, and honestly, it was a brilliant marketing hook for the tour.
It's an incredible dynamic to bring to cities across the country.
Yeah.
And that need to adapt and evolve, it didn't stop in 2024.
No, it's still going.
If we look at the theatrical landscape right now in 2026, Mrs. Doubtfire is operating like a multinational enterprise. Let's just map out what is happening actively right now.
Let's do it.
Currently, there's a second North American tour on the road. This one is a non-equity tour. And for our listeners, non-equity simply means the actors are not part of the Actors' Equity Union.
Right. It's a different tier of touring.
Exactly. These tours typically operate on a different budget scale, allowing them to play in smaller markets and regional theaters that a massive first-run tour might bypass. It started in Elmira, New York, last September, and is booked straight through August of this year.
The logistical infrastructure required to keep a show of this technical complexity on the road, especially moving into smaller regional houses, is a feat of engineering in itself.
Absolutely. And that's just the U.S. footprint. Across the Atlantic, there's a German production currently running at the Capitol Theater in Düsseldorf, which goes until next month, April 2026.
Amazing.
Plus, Gabriel Vick isn't hanging up the wig anytime soon. There is a massive UK and Ireland tour launching at the Birmingham Hippodrome this coming August, with Vick reprising his West End role.
Taking a distinctly American San Francisco-based comedy and moving it to Europe requires careful cultural translation. The humor has to land with audiences who don't necessarily share the same cultural touchstones.
And speaking of complex cultural translations, we have to talk about the Brazilian production.
Oh,
It
yes.
is titled Uma Baba Quase Perfeita O Musical, which roughly translates to An Almost Perfect Danny.
I love that title.
It's great. They cast Eduardo Sterblitch, an incredibly popular Brazilian actor and comedian, to play Daniel. They ran a massive season in Rio de Janeiro in late 2024 and then moved to São Paulo for a run from March through May of 2025.
A huge market down there.
Huge. And looking at the source material, the cast adapted as the show moved. Thais Pissa played Miranda, but for the São Paulo run, they brought in Gabriela Di Greco to play the oldest daughter, Lydia, and Fabrizio Gorziza took over the role of Frank.
It just proves that the core DNA of this story, a flawed parent going to absurd lengths to be with their kids, really transcends language barriers.
It truly does.
It does possess universal thematic appeal, but we also have to acknowledge the critical paradox here.
The reviews.
Yes. While audiences globally have embraced the show, the initial critical reception during its Broadway tenure was noticeably mixed. The material faced significant scrutiny.
What were the main critiques?
Critics often noted that despite the modern technological updates, the core plot mechanics still felt somewhat tired. Furthermore, the completely original score by the Kirkpatricks, while generally acknowledged as pleasant and energetic, was frequently criticized for being unmemorable.
So what does this all mean for the legacy of the show? It's a fascinating paradox. You have critics pointing out structural flaws, a Broadway run cut painfully short by a pandemic, and yet it is selling out in regional markets, London, Germany, and Brazil.
Right.
There has to be an engine driving this success that the critics perhaps underestimated.
The engine was undeniably the cast. While the structural material faced heavy critiques, there was near universal acclaim for the performers doing the heavy lifting. The critics championed the actors.
I mean, they had to. The physical comedy alone.
Exactly. Rob McClure received incredibly high praise for what was essentially a Herculean physical and comedic effort in the title role. Annalise Scarpacci, playing the eldest daughter Lydia, was singled out for her grounded performance. And Broadway veterans like Brad Oscar playing Frank and Peter Bartlett as Mr. Jolly brought masterclasses in comedic timing.
They really anchored the show.
The general consensus was that this ensemble was actively elevating the material. They breathed so much life, sweat, and physical comedy into the room that audiences were thoroughly entertained, regardless of any narrative shortcomings.
And the theater industry did recognize that immense effort during the 2022 awards season. The show secured several Outer Critics Circle Award nominations, including a nod for Outstanding New Broadway Musical.
Well deserved.
And Rob McClure rightfully earned a Tony Award nomination for Best Actor in a Musical, acknowledging the sheer athletic stamina required for the role. But I think my absolute favorite piece of trivia from this entire deep dive revolves around the Drama Desk Awards.
Oh, this is the best part.
Mrs. Doubtfire actually took home a Drama Desk Award that season. The winner was David Brian Brown. The category, Outstanding Wig and Hair Design.
It is so perfectly fitting, and it speaks to the hidden mechanics of theater.
It really does.
You have a massive musical where the entire central tension, the physical comedy, and the emotional climax rely entirely on a man wearing a physical disguise to fool his own family. Wigs in a show like this aren't just an aesthetic choice, they are a structural engineering challenge.
They're bearing the weight of the plot.
They really are. They have to withstand rapid-fire quick changes, aggressive choreography, and the sheer heat of stage lighting. For the production to win a major award specifically for its wigs, it's wonderful. It highlights the one technical element that absolutely could not fail if the illusion was going to work.
Exactly. If the wig looks cheap or falls apart, the suspension of disbelief vanishes and the entire emotional arc of the show collapses. They are arguably the most high-stakes hair pieces in the history of modern Broadway.
They certainly are. And when we look at the entire scope of this source material, the most critical takeaway for anyone analyzing this industry is that Mrs. Doubtfire the Musical is a definitive case study in theatrical perseverance.
Absolutely.
We have a very bad habit of viewing a Broadway opening as the ultimate finish line and a quick closure as a definitive failure. But this production shatters that metric.
It does.
It proves that a show's life is not defined solely by its tenure in New York. A strong underlying property, backed by exceptionally talented, hardworking performers, can absolutely find its footing on the road. It can adapt to international markets. It can survive a pandemic that brought the entire live entertainment industry to its knees. And it can emerge on the other side as a thriving global enterprise.
It is a massive testament to the enduring power of a good story and a reminder of just how much unseen labor goes into making us laugh. Well, that brings us to the end of our journey today.
It's been a great discussion.
It has. Thank you so much to you, our listener, for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. We hope you uncovered some new insights into the turbulent, fascinating world of theatrical development. Keep exploring those hidden backstories, and until next time, stay curious.
Though, before we completely close the book on Daniel Hillard, there is one lingering detail that is hard to shake.
So?
Yeah. This raises an important question. The creators went to great lengths to update this story with 21st century technology, weaving smartphones and constant digital connectivity into the fabric of the narrative.
Right.
But considering the sheer logistical nightmare of trying to pull off a secret double life in our modern era of high-definition cameras, social media tracking, and instant communication, does modernizing a classic 90s farce actually enhance the comedy for today's audience?
Mm.
Or does watching a character try to navigate a digital landscape in a rubber mask just make us long for the simpler analog days of 1993, when a little bit of latex, a fake Scottish accent, and a severed landline phone were all you really needed to completely fool the world?